When celebrated German film director Werner Herzog was in Pittsburgh several years ago, he chose to watch the documentaries of local filmmaker Tony Buba. A sign of Herzog's approval was his advice to Buba, steal if necessary to keep making your movies. But with the help of a Guggenheim Fellowship and NEA and Rockefeller Foundation grants, Buba hasn't had to resort to that. For more than 15 years, Tony Buba has been making movies that chronicle the decline of his hometown, Braddock, Pennsylvania. It's a former steel town just outside of Pittsburgh. When the mills shut down, the population dropped and unemployment soared. Many of the stores and churches and all of the movie theaters closed. Buba's movies have an offbeat sense of humor. For instance, his film J. Roy, New and Used Furniture, was about the opening of a new store by a Braddock businessman. Jimmy Roy had already gone broke in business 11 times, but he insisted he grew more confident with each failure and was passing on that confidence in his pep talks. Buba's latest film, Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl fantasy, is part documentary about Braddock, part autobiography about Buba's life as a filmmaker, and part fantasy. The film follows Buba as he makes a documentary on a plant closing while getting harassed by a former numbers runner named Sweet Sal, who was the subject of one of Buba's earlier films. In this scene, Buba describes one of the dilemmas he faced while making this low-budget film.
In this part of the film, Steve Pellegrino plays Jumping Jack Flash on the accordion. But you won't get to hear him play. I called about acquiring the rights to the song, but they wanted $15,000 for it. I told them, I don't want Mick Jagger to come to Braddock to sing it. I have a friend who plays it on the accordion. They still wanted $15,000. $15,000 is three times the per capita income of a Braddock resident. I didn't think it would be a politically correct move to pay that kind of money for a song. In fact, it's crazy. This isn't the Hollywood feature we're making here. I know some of you are going to think this sounds real Catholic, but when I die and get to heaven, what if, instead of St. Peter being at the gate, it's Sacco and Vanzetti? And they say to me, you paid $15,000 for a song instead of spending that money for political organizing? I wouldn't get in.
Well, Tony Buba, with Sacco and Vanzetti manning the gates of heaven, let's explore this theme of guilt a little bit further. Has this film, more than other films, brought out your fears of abandoning your politics?
Yes, it has. I mean, my politics sort of, they go back and forth to begin with, let alone, and the fear of abandoning them altogether always comes up. I mean, I wouldn't know what I would do if I was really offered a contract from somewhere or a film to direct that didn't have my political beliefs in them. Would I actually take the job or not? I mean, this is, you know, getting older, I need money for retirement. What would I do? And that does bother me.
Let me explore another aspect of your guilt. You say in the film that your success seems to be dependent on the failure of others, and that your fame and your exposure on TV seems to be directly proportionate to the number of layoffs in Braddock, which I thought was a pretty funny way of looking at it. Does that seriously bother you?
It bothers me about almost all documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
I brought it out specifically to my case, but I think for anybody doing documentary work, I mean, the people whose films get distributed the most are people doing films on AIDS right now. Anytime there seems to be a crisis, they're there with the cameras. It's a friend of mine in California, Larry Dressick, called it left-wing ambulance chasing, where you're always there at the scene, you film it, then the crew disappears. And what happens 4 or 5 years later? Nobody knows. Has the problem been solved, or is it just continuing, and there's no continuing documentation on it because it's no longer a hot issue? And people just tend to chase different issues because that's where the grant money is. I mean, some people actually study the Washington Post to find out what rules are going through, what laws are, or funding's going through Congress, and then making the film that way.
How about this? Do you have guilt that the film is personal and funny?
No, that never bothered me, being personal and funny. That that type of humor that I deal with comes from working a lot in factories when I was younger. I didn't start college until I was 25, so I spent the first 7 years working either in delivering plumbing supplies and working in factories. And that the type of humor that I do is what maintain the sanity on the factory floor while you're working on the assembly line. The humor is just really, really borders on being surreal.
Well, Lightning Over Braddock is really difficult to describe in the sense that it's several films in one. It's in part a film about you making a documentary about a plant shutdown in Braddock, and it's in part a fantasy based on a character from the town named Sal, who you'd made a documentary about before. And Sal is used to be a numbers runner and something of a con man, I take it.
Right, yeah. Sal, I've known Sal almost all my life since I was about 12, 13 years old. Actually, my family's even known him longer. He had been like an intern, like an apprentice at my grandfather's shoemaker shop when he was a kid. And that never really worked out. Then I got to meet Sal when I was about 13 years old, 12 or 13. He had a little numbers joint on the avenue. And my cousin worked for him, so I used to go there and, you know, play the number and that kind of stuff. And he was one of the older guys that always hung on a corner. You know, the type that's around 30 years old and everybody else is 15. He has the Cadillac and he sort of stands on the corner with the Stetson shoes and the alligator belts and that type of dress. Yes, I've known Sal a long time. And what happened over the years was that I was not really ever that good of friends with him, but I would help him out with different favors at different times. Then I went away to school and I hadn't seen him for a long time. I came back and I started doing these documentaries, and I did one on J. Roy. And after I did one on Jimmy Roy and it got mentioned in the paper and everything, he was really pestering me about doing a documentary on him. He said his life was a lot more interesting than J. Roy's, so I eventually made one on him.
Let's get back to your new movie. Your new movie, again, is in part a documentary about you making a documentary on a steel shutdown, and it's a part about Sal, about Sal not getting out of your life after you made that documentary about him, about Sal insisting that he's responsible for any success you've achieved, that he's the real star, and that you're somehow ending up with all the credit.
Yeah, that what happened with that idea was that it started. He did start pestering me after a while. It was like I had gotten him a job with George Romero on a film called Night Riders with a security guard, and he actually had a little bit part in that. And what happened, he was living with his brother, and they got into an argument, so he had moved out of his brother's house, and he was sort of depressed. And I said, well, and he was calling me all the time, and I was helping him get on Social Security disability. He's a real bad diabetic, and he couldn't work. So we was talking. I said, well, let's make a new film. He said, it'd be a story of me and you, a story of a documentary film. He makes a film on this person now, can't get this person out of his life. And that was where the idea came from. And he said, sure, okay. So we started shooting, and we shot one summer about, we shot a fantasy where he plays Gandhi, and we shot stuff in his room where he calls me up on the telephone all the time. And that was sort of it for about a year. Then I got a grant from the NEA, and I continued working on it. Then the whole film just kept changing as I kept working on it.
So was the way you depicted Sal in this movie of being this real pest who won't leave you alone and who really believes he's responsible for your success, was that part real at all?
Yeah, it's half real. I mean, it's exaggerated for the film, but it's fairly real. Yeah, he does believe that he's responsible for my success. And sometimes I don't know. I mean, when you're a documentary filmmaker, who is responsible for your success? I mean, it's always, if you have a weak subject, your film is not going to go anywhere. So it's always depends on the subject you're filming. And, you know, so where what is the relationship between the two? I'm traveling around the country. I'm doing a radio show like this. I go to Seattle or going to Portugal and show these films. The people I'm filming, I mean, they're on, some are on welfare, some are unemployed. What is my responsibility to them? What is their relationship? What do I have owe to the community? What does the community owe me, type of thing? And it's always going through my mind. I mean, if I moved out of Braddock, I don't know if I can make any more films about Braddock, because then I feel it is really exploiting the people I'm with.
I want to give a sense of what Sal is like. Now, the parts in which he calls you up and yells at you about how you've abandoned him and how he's really better than you are, those parts are too obscene to play.
Yeah, Sal has a way with a four-letter word. He could put so many different meanings into the use of it. It's almost like poetry. I mean, the way he uses the word, he express anger or like, dislike, it doesn't matter. He uses the same word and he does a great job in using it to express himself, but I don't think we can put it on the air.
Well, there is a scene, however, in which his car breaks down and he climbs up to the roof of the car to yell at God for abandoning him once again. And that part goes a lot easier on the obscenity. So let's hear that.
Hey, you! What are you doing to me? What are you doing to me? All you ever gave me was sickness, pain, and kept me busted from the day I was born. I've had it up to my eyeballs with you, so I'm gonna cut you loose. Understand? I'm cutting you. Kavish!
A I think in Lightning Over Braddock, you had a chance to fulfill a couple of weird fantasies of your own in the film inserts, that you use little film fantasies that mm-hmm. you've created. One of them is of Sal. There's a segment of him as Gandhi driving into into Braddock in a convertible.
That came about for... One is that I knew he would look like Gandhi with the ball wig. And also, I try to do like a combination Gandhi-Kennedy assassination. And this another reason that came about is that they were both sort of heroes when I was growing up, thinking about then also becoming disillusioned with afterwards. So I was sort of poking fun at my own self for believing in, totally believing in these two people, then realizing their faults later.
Well, it's this very funny sequence, and you've got, like, the sitar music.
Right, that's a Steve Pellegrino. He called the music Third World Gumbo. He is Steve Pellegrino, who does Jumping Jack Flash in the film and plays the accordion player. He writes all the music for me.
So when you were filming Sal as Gandhi riding into town, you had spectators lining on the streets. Lining the streets, were they... really just watching you film the shot, or ask them to be there?
No, what happened is what I did with the whole film to have crowd scenes, I'd go every time there was an event, and every year the Braddock Firemen's have a parade. So I wanted to get in front of the parade so I'd have more of a crowd, but they wouldn't let me. So I just, when the parade, the last fire truck went by, I just went in there with Gandhi, and we pulled up, and everybody was just, they didn't know what to do. And they were coming down the street, and finally we had him shot. Some people thought he had a heart attack. These kids, they're looking at their own Gumby. I was playing around with that and having the people involved in it, not really knowing what's going on, but just sort of experimenting with what happens and going with it.
In the middle of this movie, actually toward the end, you say that Sal won't talk to you anymore. They dropped out of making the movie. Was that real?
Yeah, that was real. What happened, he actually dropped out twice. It was the second time that it was totally finished. There's a scene in the film where he's supposed to be in the restaurant talking to Jimmy Roy. And Jimmy Roy was supposed to tell Sal, you have to think positive, and that's the only way you're going to make it. Well, Sal didn't want to do the scene with Jimmy. He thought Jimmy would steal the scene from him. So we had a little bit of an argument there. Then I was having a microphone problem, and I was taping, and the woman was doing a test, and she was taping Sal and Ernie talking, and Sal said something about being broke. Well, he says that a lot, and he actually said that down my house about 3 months earlier. So he came to the house, and I was just playing some sound, and he heard the sound was recorded at the restaurant, and he thought I recorded it in my home, so then he thought I was wired with a microphone at all times. And he wanted to frisk me. So we got into this big fight. We're out on the porch. He's he wants to frisk me. So I stripped down to my underwear. I said, there's no microphone. I'm starting using the four-letter words. I'm swearing at him. My mother's looking out the window. The neighbors are looking. We got into this big screaming match, and that was it. And I hadn't seen him for about 3 years, and I ran into him at the Braddock post office about a month ago. And we had a decent conversation, but that's been it.
Oh, gosh. Well, my guest is filmmaker Tony Buba, and he's made a long series of movies documenting his city, Braddock, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Pittsburgh. Most of these movies are documentaries about this small steel town, which has really been shut down with the decline of industry. His new film is called Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl Fantasy. How did you start documenting the shutting down of your town?
It started when I was in graduate school. I enrolled in a graduate film program at Ohio University. And at that time, I really didn't have much of a background. I didn't have any background in film. I went to a small state school in Pennsylvania called Edinburgh, and I got a degree in psychology, and I didn't know what to do. So I ended up, David Weinkauf, who taught there, so he said, why don't you go to film school? So I did that, and I got accepted. And I always tell the story because the head of the department was named Joe Anderson. He took anybody with a funny last name that year. He accepted Kathy Kodak, Tommy Tuttle, Tommy Tucker, and Tony Buba. He said he had to find out what a Buba looked like. And that was his sole criteria for getting into school. It was, if your grades weren't too bad, he liked people older and from different backgrounds. And I went there, and the program was fairly laid back, and the emphasis was on doing personal work. And I happened to started to come home and saw, how you're gone away for a while and you come back and see things deteriorate. And I did the first film was on the closing of my grandfather's shoemaker shop. And they were getting rid of all the equipment. So I just happened to come back later on that spring, and Jimmy Roy was having a grand opening of a used furniture store. And I thought that idea bordered on being surreal, and I filmed that. And then so I just went with it. And I got some recognition for doing that at local festivals, so I just kept with it.
Was that the key for you when this teacher suggested to you that you make personal films?
Yeah, there was, because I had, you know, the emphasis at that time was experimental work. And most people who went to OU weren't interested in going to Hollywood. It was you get your MFA and end up teaching at a university to do your own work. And I didn't have a strong art background, but I just, so they said, well, just work on what you, personal documentaries. And that was, well, that's what I started doing. And so, you know, the films range anywhere from somewhere, some are 3 minutes, some are 2 minutes, some are on my family, some are on the community. They go from 2 minutes to an hour and a half.
I guess the emphasis on personal told you where to go also, that you didn't need to go someplace else to do a documentary. You could go home and shoot the people who you knew from your childhood and the streets that you grew up on and use that.
Yeah, it was, yeah, just, and the one teacher taught home movies as a genre. And so, I mean, that just really brought it all to light with me. And I went home and I've been able, even though I live in Bragg, I've been able still to distance, you know, I live in the community and involved with people in the community, but still able to maintain a distance that I could look at things somewhat objectively.
Are there things that you've tried to avoid in your documentaries that you've seen in others and haven't liked?
Yeah, I try to avoid the sort of real humanist approach to documentaries where it's man against nature, man, noble creature, man wins out at the end. You know, I've tried to avoid that. And in Lightning Over Braddock, I really wanted to avoid the whole thing of a laid-off steel worker starts drinking, beats his wife and kids, you know, and gets a divorce, almost getting ready to get divorced, finds another job, and everything works out well in the end. I mean, that type of approach to filmmaking, I have a tough problem with. I have a tough problem with a lot of films that sort of fall into, there's like that, the realistic approach of filmmaking is a natural style, which somehow to me never really works, where they try to do a real life situation and just does it, to me, just falls apart.
Yeah, you think there ends up being a lot of platitudes and cliches in that kind
yes,
of film?
Yes, I mean, it really, I mean, you look at a lot of stuff on Working People. That's outside of, say, the opening of a film that Paul Schrader did, Blue Collar, which was really, I mean, the opening of that film, the first like 10 minutes, it was incredible, the factory work and the music and the pounding, the beat. I mean, there's been very few films that really sort of capture the spirit of people that work for a living. I won't say, what drives me nuts is when people come into Pittsburgh and they say, or a film crew comes in, I'll say, oh, these are real people here. I never, that expression always drives me crazy.
Yeah,
these, you know, I like kids because the people are real. I mean, what does that mean? These people are real. And people who live in Los Angeles, aren't the Chicanos and Asians who live in Los Angeles real? I mean, I don't know what they mean.
Did people in your family work in the steel mills?
Yeah, my father worked 40 years in the mill. He was a welder at the Edgar Thompson plant in Braddock. And it's sort of amazing when you live in a mill community. I mean, every day you see that mill. You walk down the street and you see this giant structure in front of you. And I always found them quite beautiful, actually. And I'm really sad when they tear them down. I mean, I like to just see them be there and being, even if they're abandoned, just for the architecture.
When you were young, did you assume you'd grow up and work in the mills like your father?
No. Three words of advice my father always gave me was, as soon as I got older, was never work in the mill, you know, never go to war, and move out of Braddock as soon as you can. The only thing I ever was successful at is I haven't moved out of Braddock and I haven't worked in the mill.
So, but you went to college really late when you were, how old did you start college?
I was 25 when I started college. Yeah, I had no intention. I was a really poor student in high school And I was, high school, sort of in the 1960s, you know, when I picked up one book by Camus, and, so I started going into existentialism, and everything's going to be dead by the time I'm 21, the world's going to blow up, you know, and so all of a sudden I'm 21 years old, I'm still working in the factory, the world is still around, and next thing I know I'm 24, and I'm still working on the factory floor going crazy. I don't know if anybody's worked on the assembly line, but sometimes there's nothing to do but daydream. You know, I must have played quarterback for Notre Dame and led them to national championships for 3 years in a row. And my daydreams started repeating themselves. I said, it's time to get out of here.
Now, over the years, you've been making documentary films. They're not what's totally supported you. It's hard to make a living making documentaries.
Right. I've been living... I teach part-time at the Pittsburgh Filmmakers. We offer classes there. I teach part-time at the Pittsburgh Filmmakers. And I was doing a lot of industrial video work. I do audio work on industrial videos, and that's how I'm supporting myself. But I've been real fortunate the last 3 or 4 years. This year, I got a Rockefeller Fellowship, so I'm living off of that. And I had gotten a Guggenheim like 2 years before that. And so the last 3 years, I've been actually supporting myself doing film work, my own films and these different fellowships.
Now, you've worked on a few of George Romero's horror films. You worked on Martin, which was a vampire film, and was it Dawn of the Dead?
Dawn of the Dead,
which
right.
is one of the in the zombie series.
Right. Actually, it might be my biggest claim to fame. I'm in Dawn of the Dead. I get my arm ripped off in a blood pressure machine. I'm wearing a Mexican sombrero, and I'm one of the motorcycle raiders, and they jerk my arm out of the machine. I mean, I searched everywhere to find a sombrero because I knew the film would become a cult hit. So I thought if I could find the most outrageous costume, I could be on. People can spot me on camera a lot.
No, in addition to your cameo, you did sound?
I did audio on Dawn of the Dead, right.
So you must have had to mic a lot of screams and moans and shrieks and chomping, because this is a
right.
film where the zombies are eating arms and legs and any other limb they can get their mouth on.
Right, that was, a lot of that sound was late. It was put in later with the chomping noises. Yeah, we got to record a lot of that.
You use some special effects in the new movie, in the fantasy sequences. Well, there's special effects blood for the Gandhi sequence. There's a Rambo sequence where you're shot.
Right.
And then there's a sequence where a car blows up.
Right.
You can't afford to do this on a meager independent documentary budget.
Well, you can't and you can. You can if there's an, like I said, I keep mentioning the Pittsburgh Filmmakers, which is a real valuable organization to independents because we have classes there. And one of my students, Greg Funk, wanted to do special effects. I mean, this is what he does. He's getting really good at it. And he went to part of a resume reel. He says, well, can we blow up a car? I said, sure. So he went out and bought Sal's old Cadillac. It was a rusted down Cadillac. It wasn't running. And we blew it up. And he did all the blood and the different special effects. And like other people, like John Bick and Brady Lewis, people involved with the filmmakers, you know, they give me crew help. And there's some people I haven't mentioned, and they might get mad, but like Susan Howard. I mean, these people are around the filmmakers, and they volunteer the time. We take turns working on each other's projects. And if it wasn't for people like that, I wouldn't know where I'd get the film finished.
Once you directed a car blowing up, did it give you the urge to do more?
It sort of does, like getting a tattoo. You know, once you do one, you know, you want another one. I keep thinking, well, there's these Squirrel Hill tunnels in Pittsburgh. What if we had someone driving through the tunnels and placing someone's head through the railing, and the car comes back and knocks the head off? You know, and I have an idea now for which I'm trying to write of Phantom of the Blast Furnace, where it would be like a horror film where an unemployed steelworker is living in a blast furnace and ends up attacking corporate leaders. This is a script I'm starting to work on.
What happens when you show your movies to the people in Braddock who are in it? And I'm asking this because you have a really offbeat sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And also some of the people in the film do curse profusely.
Yeah,
and although it's about your town, I can imagine some people in the town being a little offended.
Yeah, there's a couple different reactions. The first time I ever showed them in Pittsburgh, Sal was there and Jimmy Roy was there. And after I got done showing the Sweet Sal film, Sal got up and started talking. That's not me up there. I was just acting that whole time. I don't really act like that. And it seemed like the film never ended because he just went into this whole monologue after the film. And Jimmy Roy got up on stage afterwards and started plugging his store and where they could buy different jewelry. People perceive themselves when they see themselves on the screen. I mean, they remove it from a distance. I've never – what I do in editing – is that if I'm not comfortable at that time with what they're saying to make fun of what they've said on the spot, then I don't use it in the film because then I think it's being too exploitive. But if Jimmy would say something that it sounds real stupid, if I can't say, hey, Jimmy, that's dumb, you know, how can you even think that? If I can't say it to him then I won't use it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the criteria I go by.
You're staying in Braddock, at least for the time being.
Right.
Do you think that there are some people in Hollywood who really enjoy knowing that there's people like you staying in your hometown? Reassuring in it?
I don't know. There's lip service paid to mm-hmm. to that. But you also get, if you stay in your hometown, you also get categorized doing like regional cinema.
Right.
And sometimes that takes on the nation of doing folk art or something. It's not uh-huh. quite good enough to be New York or Los Angeles. And, you know, I find that real insulting.
So you feel you're patronized.
Yeah, you know, it's really fine regional cinema. You know, get out of here with that term. Right? You know, regional cinema. You go see some of the films that are out there. I mean, they're not that good. And I do feel patronized with that term. I mean, it is regional cinema in the sense that I'm from the area, but I don't want it it's not as a folk art type of approach to it.
I remember John Waters, the filmmaker who's lived in Baltimore for so long, once saying that he felt like he'd never be able to leave because he'd made such a big deal about being in Baltimore that now he'd never be able to get out even if he wanted to leave. And Fran Lebowitz, it was the same way about stopping smoking. She'd made such a big thing about being a smoker. She'd never be able to stop. Do you ever feel that way about living in Braddock, that when you want to get out, that you might not be able to because you're so identified with it and such a part of your thing?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, the other day we were thinking about it because my father, before they started working in the mill, they used to have a small farm in Braddock Hills, and they were farmers, and there was a little bit of land up there. I said, boy, it'd be nice to build a house up here. But then if I build a house up here, then I'm living in Braddock Hills, which is only a half a mile away, but I'm no longer living in Braddock. Or I saw a teaching job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I said, well, you know, if I move there, but then I keep saying on these interviews that how much I'll be in Braddock and stay in Braddock. You know, I do feel... I don't know if I'm getting myself into a bind or not by saying I'll stay in Braddock. And I haven't had a thought for a film that hasn't generated from Braddock ever. When I was finishing getting my degree, you had to do your oral interviews, and one of the instructors asked me, he said, well, do you think you can make a film outside of Braddock? I said, well, I don't think I ever had to. And so far, I haven't, but I don't know if I am sort of putting myself into this trap. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your movies. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.